This week's episode of the Mad Tech Podcast was recorded in Singapore in front of a live audience. While the content quality is great, the audio quality is not up to our usual standard, for which we apologise. Please bear with us and we hope you enjoy the episode.
Okay, so welcome everyone to the very first live recording of our Mad Tech podcast here in Singapore. It's really exciting to be able to run this session here in Singapore, as I mentioned earlier, for the benefit of everybody that's listening when we post this online. We've had a couple of prior sessions to our chat this afternoon. I was explaining the format for the podcast. So what I'm going to do is reintroduce myself for the benefit of everyone listening and ask my panelists to introduce themselves as well so that people can decipher one another's voices from who's speaking. So I'm Rachel Smith, COO with ExchangeWire, and Mike, let me start with you.
I'm Mike Chawla. I'm Senior Director of Product Management at Thematic.
Hi, Mike. Janet?
Hi, I'm Janet Leong. I look after product and supply for Publicis Media position, the programmatic arm.
Okay. I'm Stefan Joel. I handle GrabFood for the region.
Excellent. Great. So welcome, everyone, to this edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. As is our format for this session, I'm going to kick off and start with discussion of a couple of news stories that are pertinent to advertising and marketing that have occurred over the last week or so, and get some views from each of you on those before we then dive into a bit of a chat about the focus for our discussion today, which is the value of in-app advertising for brands. So let's kick it off with the first news story of the week. This is a news story actually that was published very late last week by Ronan Shields, who is a journalist and editor for Adweek in New York, writing a piece that was focusing on some speculation that Google is set to implement browser privacy restrictions. This kind of, and that would actually then result in blocking third-party tracking capabilities in Chrome, in the Chrome browser. This is somewhat connected to other developments in the industry in terms of browser privacy. So obviously Apple launching ITP 2.0 for Safari, other browser privacy-first browsers such as Mozilla Firefox and Brave, issuing their own sort of privacy initiatives within those browsers. So one could argue that if Google were to implement this, this is somewhat keeping pace with others in the sort of browser and search part of the industry. But obviously, it's a big news story for advertising and marketing because it potentially has huge ramifications for the industry. It could push us to having to operate in a world where we're not cookie dependent. Obviously, our discussions here today have been very mobile focused, so there's a little bit of relevant read across there. And I think the other thing that's really important about this story is that Ronan made very clear in his writing of the story that whilst nothing's been decided within Google yet, there's obviously a lot of debate from across various departments within Google, because you can see that they rightly have a responsibility to take users' privacy very seriously, so you can't blame them for considering this move. But then on the other hand, we know that it would cause a great restriction, particularly to the technology side of the ad tech industry, and it would also potentially throw a lot of heat on them with regards to anti-competition issues. So I wanted to throw it open to my panelists and ask you in the first instance, what do you think Google's going to do here? Do you think they're actually going to take this step and implement, you know, serious restrictions on use of third-party tracking tools? And if they do, what do you think the impact for the industry is going to be? So, Mike, let me start with you.
So I think it's hard to predict what they're going to do because I think this is a difficult problem for them, right? Because there's really three things they could do. They could leave third-party cookies in place and then risk Chrome losing share as users move to other browsers. They could implement restrictions that don't really restrict Google's ability to track people off-site, or they could do firmer restrictions that restrict Google's ability to track Google and everyone else's ability to track, and that would have a big impact on their revenue. I think if they do go for the option that restricts everyone else, but Google is just going to throw a ton of fuel on the antitrust fire. So I think it's a very risky maneuver for them because it'll give the critics a lot of ammunition. So yeah. They really shouldn't be able to have this like huge vertical integration between search, the browser, all the way down the ad tech stack. So I'm really interested to see what they're going to do. I think it is a difficult a difficult conundrum for them.
Yeah.
And it will be a huge earthquake to the ad tech world if Chrome does remove third-party cookies.
And kind of instant as well, right? Because, as in, it will have an instant impact on the industry. Because
it won't even be instant. I mean, I suspect that they will announce it and there will be some time before it is implemented. That's what they've done with other big changes in Chrome.
Yep.
But I mean, I would expect that would be, you know, maybe a quarter.
Yeah.
And so it will really shift, you know, how people, what publisher revenue looks like, how ads are bought, and it's probably the most significant change, you know, that could happen.
Absolutely, and actually that's interesting on the publisher revenue side of things. I mean, you know, it is an immediate restriction in terms of publishers' ability to monetize their revenue, right? What's your perspective on that from, you know, working within a sort of a sell-side technology platform?
Well, so right now, if traffic that doesn't have cookies just is much less valuable. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that would be a massive, I mean, perhaps catastrophic to some publisher drop-off. You know, buyers are going to have to adapt to this. So it'll be really interesting to see what happens. I mean, people speculated something similar could happen in Europe with GDPR.
Yeah.
And the way that it ended up getting implemented was that the consent rates were higher than people expected.
Yeah.
So there's still a lot of buying going on in cookies. But I think it'd be a really large short-term revenue disruption as DSPs, everyone on the buy side has to figure out, okay, how are we going to buy advertising if we can't tie it to user behavior? Because right now they don't value it very highly, and that low valuation sticks, it would be severe impact.
Yeah. And I've got a few more thoughts on that, but Janet, I want to move on to you first, just to get your perspective. What do you think Google's going to do here?
I pretty much agree with what Mike just said, and I think Google, as we all know, is a revenue-driven company, so they're not going to do something too immediate because that's really going to impact them a lot. We're going to lose out on attribution, we're going to lose out on measurement. A lot of our clients are heavily dependent on just dropping a cookie on the website. But if I think about it, it's actually not a bad thing to really start having some discussion around this, because eventually people will have to move on from just the cookie space, because that's what we're spending time right here talking about mobile. But that really forces the advertiser, I'm coming from an advertiser perspective, like being better at collecting first-party data, owning that data, and utilizing that across like different environment, and actually owning that. Right now, I think a lot of advertisers are just kind of lazy doing the short-term thing and really just cookie bombing everyone and collecting cookies in a very short-term perspective. Mm-hmm. But that really should never be the strategy. It should be more of a long-term goal, and it really should be more strategically thought of and really considering all, you know, environment and IDs.
I think that's a really interesting point, right? I suppose the upside, frankly, whether Google do this or not, could be that it really pushes parts of the industry to think about life beyond a cookie environment, and to start to reconsider issues such as identity and how you build a good user identity. Stefan, what would you say from a brand marketer's perspective?
Yeah, I mean, at the same time, I mean, that would, you know, heighten the war garden, you know,
yes.
More, right? So, I mean, if we look at a statistic in this region, Chrome browsers have about 60% of the market share. And, you know, we have that, you know, same problem for the Safari already, right? But Safari, we don't felt the effect too much because, you know, it was about 12% of the market share, right? I mean, we can already see in the news that, you know, there's some uncertainty about this news. You can see the effect on some of the ad tech company shares, right? So Criteo, you know, being one of them, you know, being hit very hard. So, I mean, if that's going to happen, then it's going to be a massive impact on the whole industry. But at the same time, right, so on the other hand, it's going to draw a lot of the antitrust, you know, scrutiny to Google as well. You know, just being fined, you know, $1 billion in Europe, I think Google will want to tread very carefully, you know, how they want to go about this. But in my opinion, I think what will end up probably is there's going to be some tightening on the user privacy, but I don't think they're going to go a long way off, you know, what Safari has done.
Yeah, interesting. And it's really interesting that you raise the issue around privacy and how it might, around sort of regulation and how it might fuel that fire. You know, we talk a lot at Exchange Wire, particularly our CEO, Kieran, is very vocal in his views about how companies like Google and Facebook ought to be thought of in an anti-competitive way, and ought they to be broken up. We know that in the US, you know, Democratic hopeful presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren is really keen on the notion of implementing legislation and policy that would mean that these big tech companies are considered within a particular specific status that means they can't own and operate a platform. And it sort of feels like Google's kind of caught in the middle of that with this particular initiative, because the second they would make a decision like this, it would be so easy to throw that antitrust light on them. And I wonder, do you guys think that that might push regulators to act a little more quickly if they were to take this decision? What would you say to that, Mike?
Well, I certainly think it will draw intense scrutiny. I think in the United States, a lot of it depends who wins the next election, like how strong antitrust enforcement will be. But yeah, if they take a decision that harms everyone else, and then Google, with their having the largest share in exchanges, in DSPs, and then do something that essentially gives them a huge comparative advantage, I think it
and
will,
crushes other businesses
crushes
at the same
other
time.
Businesses. I think it will. It will definitely heighten the calls for them to break up or at least divest the DoubleClick business. Mm. And so, I do think if they go down that route, it probably makes it inevitable that they will be
heat.
Well, that they will end up having to divest. These legal processes take a really long time. It just doesn't seem a tenable situation where they can advantage themselves, even if they're doing it in the name of user privacy. Seems too anti-competitive.
Yeah. For the benefit of everyone listening, there's a few wry smiles being exchanged here on the panel and in the audience. Also, I wondered as well, so I'd be interested in everyone's view on this, but Janet and Stefan, let's start with you. I wondered as well, if this is maybe from Google's perspective, if they are seriously considering it, I know there might be a number of reasons why they're doing it, but it looks to me like it's not just about protection potentially of their advertising business, but of their search business, because are we going to see people shifting actually to other browsers, to other web browsers, maybe for data privacy reasons? Are we going to see people actually, if there was a credible alternative to Chrome, can we see that might be something that might send users in that direction? And do you think Google are getting nervous about that? Janet, maybe starting with you?
I'm coming from a more APAC perspective.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to change people's behavior.
Yeah.
I really don't think people are going to change their behavior just because of that.
Yeah.
I mean, look at just the pure GDPR thing that got rolled out in the EU. The effect that's being felt here in APAC is
minimal.
There was a lot of discussion initially, but after like a month or two, everything just kind of died down and people kind of forgotten about it.
Yeah.
So I really don't think, people are just going to change their ingrained behavior so quickly and just because of that one thing. Like, if anything, I feel like people are actually going to adopt more towards it and find alternatives and actually, other solutions to just make it work.
Yeah.
Yeah, just building on to Janet's point, right? Probably in a lot of the developed markets like North America, Australia, New Zealand, people, users generally are more educated about different alternatives. But a lot of the Southeast Asia market, a lot of the Apple market, people come into the online for the first time. The only search, browser that they know is Chrome and Google.
Yeah.
Right? They don't know there is alternative exists. So, like Janet said, it's quite hard to change your behavior. And for a lot of the people in this part of the world, I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah. And I suppose, inertia is a powerful thing, right? People have a tendency to just kind of continue doing what they've always done unless there's a really big reason to start.
There was a shift to Chrome, right? I've been in the industry long enough to remember when Internet Explorer was the dominant browser, right? Like, people had to change their behavior. They had to go out and download Chrome if they were on Windows devices. It came to Internet Explorer. I think it is a big worry point for Google, for the search business, because they, if users switch away from Chrome, they essentially have to buy that search traffic back to be the default in these other browsers.
Yeah.
And it's very expensive for them. Like, there was a report last year that they're paying Apple 9 $1 billion to be the default search engine in Safari. So if Chrome loses share, that's going to essentially increase their cost to be the default search engine in other browsers. So that's why I think it's a big conundrum.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. And I wonder if maybe we might, if we were to see some real user change in user behavior in terms of search and browsers, using the browsers that everybody uses, maybe we'll see that charge led perhaps in the US or maybe in Europe, where there are a lot of European countries where people are very, very focused on privacy and feel very strongly about it. Countries like Germany, where they're really fastidious about protecting individuals' privacy. You can imagine, couldn't you, in a marketplace like that, that some of these privacy-first browsers, like Brave, for example, could start becoming really popular. As soon as it becomes really popular, as soon as the functionality starts getting refined and the technology gets sophisticated, you might start to see a shift. Because I'm trying to think, that was a good example, Mike. I'm trying to think, what made me download Chrome again? It was so many years ago, I can't remember.
Well, Internet Explorer,
it was just better than all the other browsers.
A long time ago, my job was to build web acceleration technology. And I often said, like, I was essentially getting paid to fix things that Internet Explorer should have fixed. There are other things we could do to make things faster. Internet Explorer at that time wasn't as smart as it could be. And so Chrome became the better alternative. Like, when Chrome first came out, it was faster. It was just a better experience overall. And then beyond this privacy thing, I think Chrome, like, I feel like it's sort of turned into like the new Internet Explorer. It's slow, it eats up all the RAM on my machine. Like, so it's kind of gone through that cycle where it started off being like the new, better experience alternative, and now it's kind of turned into this incumbent that maybe doesn't provide the best possible experience.
And maybe it just requires a new shiny alternative version.
There's one browser that's beating Chrome is there at their own game, right? So I was reading about it, and there's one browser called UC Browser. So that's super popular in India and Indonesia. So what they're trying to do is in this part of the world is the connection is pretty spotty, and the data packages stay pretty expensive. So the in a lot of these countries in Indonesia and India, right? So people have a lot of low-end Android smartphone, and UC Browser, it takes about 35 megabyte compared to Chrome 150 megabyte to download it, and a lot of people are opting for that, right? So I think rather than behavior, it's more the conditions that will drive the people towards the alternative.
And what about, before we move on to the next news story, what about just a word on a sort of life for ad tech and marketing tech beyond the cookie? We are focusing today on mobile, so obviously that's a clear opportunity. But do you think that it's useful and constructive for the industry to think about other ways of targeting and attaching measurement tools?
Well, I think in the industry's ideal world, we have an advertising identifier from the browser, like we do. Now, do I think we're going to get one of those? No. So then when you talk about on the web without cookies, you're either talking about first-party data or contextual targeting. And I think it varies widely on publishers, like the value of the first-party data they have. I've heard this like from DSPs that general news sites, the first-party data isn't bad. Interesting. So I think it would have a sort of disparate effect on publishers. If they're in areas that have really valuable first-party data, that they probably comparatively like lump the impact for them. I think it kind of remains to be seen. In this world, like DSPs would probably have to get a lot better at contextual targeting.
Yeah. What do you guys think, Jana, Stefan?
I think there's definitely a lot of catch-up still be done. The advertising business is built on cookies, and it's built on that for years. And although mobile has been around for such a long time, we are really just about to catch up in terms of measurement, collection of data, and all these kind of things, which is really baffling because if you think that mobile is such a big part of our lives, and yet we're still just getting there. So I think there's still a lot to be seen. To be developed.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of companies are trying to connect dots, between the mobile web and, in Avatar, right? So being a digital, native brand, as Grab, so we do work a lot on the in-app environment as well. Definitely there are a lot of, positive things, advantages, in the in-app environment in terms of identifying, right? I think if this Chrome, you know, the whole thing is going to happen. I think it's we're really shift the industry to focus more on the deterministic identifier.
Yeah.
But how that will play out, I think it's not, we're not quite sure.
Remains to be seen. Yeah. Great. Okay. I want to move us on to the second news story because we're in danger of diving into the in-app conversation before we finish that one. So let's go on to the second news story. And apologies to everyone in the room for the slightly dodgy sound. Hopefully everyone that's listening can hear us clearly, listening on the podcast, I mean. So second news story is actually about auction mechanics. It's a Google announcement as well. It was Google's decision, which was made a couple of weeks ago now, to move to a unified first price auction model in their ad management platform. We haven't had a chance to discuss this on the MadTech podcast yet, so I thought today would be a really good opportunity for it. This means that, you know, previously the platform had relied on a second price auction model, which meant that obviously the resulting buyer, the winning bid, paid just a little bit more than the second price bid. Now, a winning bidder within this new auction mechanics will pay the price that they bid for the impression. So I just wanted to get your impression of your opinion of Google's moves here. There's been a lot of feedback within the industry that suggested that it's sort of long overdue and that actually the bulk of the industry had already automatically kind of moved to a first price unified auction model anyway. So is that what you're seeing within your areas within the business, or does this feel like, you know, it's actually a useful mechanism that will drive a lot of people into a sort of a better, more cleaner auction environment?
So pretty much every other exchange had already moved to first price auctions. And the reason being that when you get into this multi-level auction, which is essentially what like programmatic advertising has become, second pricing anywhere but at the very end potentially makes you uncompetitive. Right, and if the bidder willing to pay the most, they can get second price down to a lower bid as it gets fed upstream, and they actually don't win the auction, which is just like economically inefficient. So I think the reason that Google ended up making the move is that while they were second pricing against direct line item in the ad server, they were not second pricing against exchange bidders. So, and my guess is that their win rate started to decline in ad apps because of this. I don't think it's going to have a huge impact because so much of the industry had already moved on. The one thing that I think will happen is that because this is essentially the death knell for second price auction, Google's moving on. In a first price auction world, bid shading is a really important technology for DSPs. And so DSPs really have to become good at it. Like, I don't think you can be a competitive DSP in a world where everybody is first price without being really good at bid shading.
And can you just say a little bit about bid shading first?
So when you go to bid in an auction, in a second price auction, it makes sense to just bid what you think the item is worth to you, in this case, the ad impression. So I think it's worth $5 CPM to me, I'll bid $5. But in a first price auction, you don't want to bid that anymore because you'd rather like pay less. So you have to kind of estimate what you think everyone else will pay. Like, I think this is worth up to $5 CPM to me, but I think this auction is going to close at $3. So I will bid shade. I won't bid my full value. I'll say, well, I think it'll close at $3. Let me give myself a little room. I will pay $3.50. And so figuring out, like, what I think that where this auction will close and what the right amount to kind of cut my maximum value on that impression, like in that second price world, DSPs only had to figure out, like, how much is this worth to me? Now they have to figure out, well, how much should I bid for it so I maximize my surplus, that difference between what the auction closes at and what my true max value is. And so because Google has gotten rid of second price auction, right, they all have to be good at bid shading. And so what this means for the publishers, you know, publishers aren't fans of bid shading, right? They'd obviously like to get the highest value for their impression. So floor setting becomes much more important to kind of set that minimum value that they want to sell those impressions for. And so I think that will be the biggest effect, that like DSPs will all get better at bid shading, publishers will have to get better at floor setting. And I think like the vendors that help publishers will probably.
And does this sort of clear things up from a transparency perspective then? Because I thought the notion of you know, moving to a first price auction model was in response to calls for more greater transparency, particularly from the buy side of the industry. Is this a better solution?
Well, I think in the long run it is better for buyers because they take full control over what they want to pay for impressions. And it does get rid of that question about, you know, what the auction dynamics are, so it really simplifies things. But I mean, my take on it is that the move to first price for ad exchanges had more to do with there being these downstream auctions and like a lack of competitiveness by cutting the bid too early. Because from an economic theory point of view, second pricing only really makes sense at the very, very
end. Buyers. Janet, Stefan, what do you think of this?
I just really want to touch the point on transparency, whether that actually going to give a lot more transparency. I just don't think that will be the case because, to be honest with you, I think auction dynamics have been so complex and getting more involved over time. And to be honest, I think it's actually the buyer's job and the agency's job to really examine every single step of the way, you know, supply path optimization.
Yep.
We actually really need to look at every single step to going on, and to be honest with you, I don't think a lot of people are actually doing that because it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of effort, and I don't think that kind of transparency will really be available until we start doing those kind of things. But back to your questions on, you know, Google, is this long overdue? Definitely. Yeah. When it came out, I was like, okay,
finally.
They're finally doing it.
Yeah.
So that was literally my response, and when I spoke to them directly, I would say, you know, if anything, they really just should just give a bit more education and communication with the buyers, like, and just helping the buyers really understand how that's going to immediately affect them. But the good thing is our traders are well informed of these kind of things, so I don't think we're going to be as, you know, we're not going to be surprised by it. It's something that we have been accustomed to it for the past year or so. So that to me is, you know, totally like, oh, okay, finally there. But one point I do want to make from a, you know, because I manage supply, one thing I do like to say is because of that, there's, you know, we've seen a lot of shift into just PMPs, you know, instead of going through the auction dynamics and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, as a group, we've really started moving a lot of our buying into just setting up different kinds of PMPs and really getting a bit more control over that.
Yeah.
And I think that's a way to really combat all these different kinds of, like, you know, changes in auction dynamics.
Complex auction, auction mechanics, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, all these different things are happening.
So do you think that this is going to result in more of that? You're going to be moving to more PMPs?
We're already doing
close?
It.
Yeah.
So as a group, we're already kind of doing that. Like
controlled environment.
Yeah, yeah, controlled environment. It's kind of funny when you think about it. It's like kind of going full circle.
Yeah.
We start off with, like, you know, direct IOs and went into programmatic, and then now we're
and now you're going,
like,
back.
Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Stefan, what's your experience at Grab?
I mean, from the buyer perspective, this is not just for Grab. I think it depends on the buying method that you're using, right? So I think it will affect most if you are buying flat CPM across, right? But instinct, the first instinct you would probably want to do is you would definitely want to know the bid price, right? Because you will be thinking, you know, am I extracting enough value out of it? Am I overpaying? But for a lot of performance campaigns, if you think about it, we're not bidding flat, right? So that the algorithm take care of, you know, how much to bid for each and every impressions. So a lot of performance campaigns are already on, you know, optimized CPA, optimized CPC, you know, kind of bidding. So I thought that's going to impact a lot. And then moving forward, like what Jan say, you know, or what's going to happen, likely to happen is advertiser, a lot of the brand advertiser would like to have the control and kind of like guarantee over, you know, I have this amount of budget and I want to, you know, deliver this amount of impression reach, and this is what I'm going to buy. We're going back to, you know, buying based on flat CPM, PMP, fixed price PMP. Again, might happen for a lot of the brand advertisers, right? From performance side, what we have seen increasingly is the you know, optimization part. So I recently talked to a company called Sidebit. So they do algorithm as a service, right? So you can bring your own algorithm to your DSP or to sit on top of your existing DSP, right? If you see that off-the-shelf, you know, algorithm from DSP is not enough, then you can build your own algorithm, and they will listen to different, you know, signals and try to bid differently, right? right? So I think over long term, I think this is where the performance marketing industry is going in terms of
heading that direction.
Exactly. Because human traders can only do so much in terms of optimization, right? When you layer on top of with the algorithms, you know, that can listen to thousands of signals, and I think it's going to be more efficient.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Does that surprise you at all, Mike, to hear that from the buy side, or just
a little bit? Yeah. Well, because like in the US, we've been hearing from some on the buy side that they're actually less interested in PMPs.
Yeah.
Because a lot of their sort of historical interest in PMPs had to do with making sure the inventory is what they said it was, that it's not fraudulent, and that we've been hearing that because there have been a lot of strides in cleaning up the open market, things like ads.txt, that buyers were more comfortable buying in open market, and were, you know, PMPs always had some overhead with them, and it could be hard to keep working properly. So we've actually seen in the U.S. declining interest in PMPs. So it's really interesting to hear that in this market, it's rising.
It's the other way around, yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, Janet, go on.
No. I just want to add, because I think from the U.S., there's a level of sophistication and full understanding of the media that you're buying. And people are more willing to actually apply, like, third-party verification on top. Whereas I think in this market, it's still very fragmented. You still have a lot of different vendors out there who don't necessarily know what they're really measuring. And, you know, your clients don't necessarily want to pay for that either. So, you know, in order for us to guarantee that level of quality and control, we kind of have to shift that way as well. And I think that's just a difference in terms of markets and understanding.
Different levels of sophistication within markets. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Great. Okay, so I am going to move us on from the news of the week to the topic for conversation today, which is why brands should embrace in-app advertising. Now, for the benefit of everyone listening to the podcast, we've already, as I mentioned earlier, had a little bit of a prelude discussion. So we have talked quite extensively already about the value of mobile advertising, but I'm going to ask you guys some more specific questions around in-app, and also I'm really interested in your opinions as opposed to some of the opinions that we've heard already this afternoon. So this should be an interesting conversation. So, you know, it's arguably a mobile environment can offer brands and buyers better data and targeting capabilities. We've kind of hit on that through some of our discussions this afternoon. But we know that brands and marketers are still a bit reluctant to embrace in-app advertising specifically, and we've talked about the issues as to why that's the case. But I'd like to hear your perspective on where you think there's some reluctance and why you think that reluctance is in place, and whether it's about a lack of confidence of brands putting spending in that environment, or whether it's got to do with perhaps a lack of sophistication on the technology side of the industry, where we're just looking for technology tools and solutions to catch up. And actually, Janet, I want to start with you, because I know that in preparation for this, we had a little bit of a chat about your experience and background at Publicis. As you also just mentioned, you've worked in the US and now you're here in the APAC market. So you might have a bit of a different perspective on this from some of the other speakers we've heard from this afternoon.
Well, actually, I agree with a lot of what people said earlier, but I like to add, like, from my side, I think that reluctance is really, well, first off, there's a lot of, you know, lack of understanding in mobile in general, and mobile in-app specifically, and also I think there's been a lot of, like, you know, bad news and bad rap against mobile for the longest time, and it's still happening. So I think on that front, it really doesn't help when it comes to, you know, adoption. Like, you know, if you constantly hear some fraudulent activity happening, you're constantly, this is like nonstop, and you can't really capture that or really fight it, then naturally, from an advertiser's perspective, we're just going to be, hey, let's not advertise within the in-app space.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times, you know, we're not, you know, as an agency, we're obviously trying our best to constantly educate our clients, but to be very honest with you, like, I think it's an ongoing effort, because we still need to do it, and we still need to do a lot of it, and this is something that I think agencies need to do a much better job as well, in terms of just educating our clients, in terms of, you know, advertising in the mobile in-app space. And this is something that, you know, Publicis Media has really been committing into, and really just educating our clients and our agencies in terms of, you know, what is the benefit over there. You know, what are some of the stats that are already showing? Like, I recently did a mobile workshop with one of our banking clients, and one of the stats that I saw was like, wow, we spent over $400 million in app for the last year in 2018 in Singapore. And that's just in Singapore.
Which is huge.
Yeah, and I was like, wow, this is a really big number.
Yep.
So for me to be surprised, and I'm fully aware of, you know, all these stuff, I just think, you know, we need to make this fully aware to our clients as well and let them understand what is the missed opportunity over there. So I think, you know, education is something that we need to do better. And I think industry as a whole, we just need to do better in not having those, you know, bad news.
Preconceived ideas.
Yeah.
And I just want to touch a little bit on that education piece. I mean, you've sort of already articulated this. What are the ways in which you educate your clients in that manner? Is it that you're literally going in, sitting them down, looking at some scenarios, you know, looking at various campaigns and using some stats and facts and figures to back up your argument? I mean, presumably you'll be starting from the point of view of assessing their needs and their marketing goals and so forth, but is it literally an education piece on behalf of the agency towards your brand clients?
Yeah, so that's one part of it, but a lot of times what we're trying to do a bit smarter and more efficiently as well is we want to make sure that everyone within the agency group, like Publicis Media as a whole, has the same level of understanding, same level of like education. So we've internally been doing so many workshops and trainings like as a group, in our, because we're all sitting in the same office, so that makes it a lot easier.
Yeah.
Just to do that first, and then, you know, if they need additional support, more, you know, in-depth training, more in-depth workshop, then we really come together to really put something catered to the client.
Yep.
And that's where we really drill down in terms of, you know, what is the client's needs are, or do we need to dig more into, you know, measurement and attribution, all these different aspects of things, so that we can, you know, provide even more level of understanding and knowledge.
And I want to branch out to you two guys in a minute as well, but I'm just really interested in this. So have you got some examples of where that's worked really, like, innovatively, where a client has started off saying, not interested in mobile, not, you know, for these reasons, don't want to go there, and you've been able to turn them around and say, actually, you should really consider this, and you've seen some really good results?
Yeah, so we did a workshop actually this year, and it's actually specifically about gaming.
Oh, right, yeah.
So we spent a lot of time telling them, people from all age and all demographics.
The gaming audience isn't what you think it might be.
Love to play games, so really don't exclude gaming.
Yeah.
There's really no point over there.
Was this like a light bulb moment to the client?
We can ask the clients to go to MRT on MRT and, like, just take a look at it. People play on MRT.
I was
like,
just
different
thinking,
ages,
absolutely.
Like, you know, playing
yeah,
I couldn't agree more. It's like Tom's example earlier on of being on a flight and chatting with his, you know, 50-year-old seat neighbour who's talking about how much he enjoyed playing your games on his phone.
Yeah, so I think, you know, I think they know. They just don't like to admit it, you know?
Yeah.
So it's kind of making that fully aware and making it very visible and in front of them. Like, and with stats, obviously, there's a lot of stats already out in the market. So it's not that hard to showcase it. So it's really just making it very visible and helping them understand that, you know, there's nothing wrong with gaming. There's everything that you can benefit from it. You can target so many different demographics. There's so many different kind of data points that you can really leverage on as well. And that really worked. And the other thing is, I think, you know, with innovation and technology development, there's been a lot of new things that are happening. Like AR, VR is starting to become more available within the app space as well, or just within the mobile environment. And, you know, with all these new things that are happening, you know, I think this also got the client a little bit more excited. So, you know, that in conjunction of just putting stats in front of them just really made them more interested and more willing to adopt, you know, mobile in-app.
Interesting. Stefan, tell us about what happens at Grab. I mean, I know you guys are big advocates of in-app advertising.
Totally. So a lot of the native, you know, digital native client brands like Grab, you know, Zalora, Lazada, I think they're using the in-app, they're embracing the in-app environment already, right? I think a lot of the resistance will probably come from a lot of the brand advertisers. During my, you know, past life in the agency, I see that the two things, right? One is the fraud. Right, there are a lot of fraud that can happen within in-app. And I mean, that can be manageable. So for example, we work with MC Saatchi and we work with our different partners, right? So we put the fraud, our own fraud rules, and we tell the partner in advance, these are our fraud rules, and, you know, if, you know, you break it, we're not going to pay for it, right? So we work with a partner that way, and MC Saatchi helps us monitor, you know, the whole lock level data. And then the second piece is around, I think, is the branch safety, right? So I think that the conversation has shifted from whether the in-app is brand safe, because back in the days, about 2-3 years ago, if you asked the independent measurement agency, can we measure, you know, in-app viewability, I think there were a lot of difficulty because historically, the independent, you know, measurement agency has been always based on the script, right? But for in-app measurement, you need an SDK adoption. With IAB, you know, open market SDK, I think that has helped a lot in terms of the measuring brand safety and the viewability. So if we tackle these two together, you know, and you know, with, together with you know what a lot of agencies are doing in terms of the
education,
I think we'll slowly see the you know adoptions in terms of the in-app measurement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mike, what's your perspective from a sort of technology point of view?
So I think there are a lot of technology improvements going on to address a lot of these concerns. Open measurement, SDK from the IAB is really going to simplify measuring viewability through fraud detection from independent vendors. It's like one of the most common questions I get at Programmatic is about what is our support for open measurement. It seems to have a lot of momentum in the industry. So I expect by the end of 2019, it's going to really be widely available.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends on the market too. Like in the U.S., there's a lot. We hear frequently there's a lot of buyers who just will not buy inventory that is not measurable.
Yeah.
So it's creating a lot of momentum there. I think another important development on the fraud front is the mobile app ads at TXT. IAB just finalized the specification last week, and that really like helped clean up on for web traffic when as a TXT was adopted there. So we expect a similar outcome on mobile because it really helps the buyers know, okay, is this an authorized channel for this? Is it direct or indirect? We see buyers who want to buy direct traffic, and having the standards in place really allow them to do that. Matic, one of the things we just recently announced that on May 1st we're going to start enforcing the as a TXT for mobile apps as well.
Yeah.
So I think as we do these development, as we do these kind of industry improved technology, that's going to go a long way to addressing some of these buyer concerns for in-app around both major ability.
And do you think it's a bit of a case of a couple of the things that we mentioned actually in connection with the last two news stories, which is that maybe buyers and agencies, for that matter, need to take some responsibility for educating themselves and for also maybe setting some boundaries and some parameters in terms of the things that concern them the most about advertising in that mobile environment. And then that is maybe pushing some of the technology innovations on the tech side of the industry. Do you think that?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. When we hear from the buy side, like, we've got a significant portion of our campaigns that will only buy inventory that is viewability measurable, that definitely affects how we think about it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, then if we are not able to measure that inventory, we know people won't buy it. So when the buy side is saying we have to have these things in place to buy, it definitely affects how ad exchanges think about these issues. I mean, the other thing I would say from the buy side is that I think it's really important to vet your supply partners and really work with partners that are committed to high quality inventory and have good practices around how to weed out fraud. I think that should be from the buy side, that should be one of the, when you select your supply partners, that should be
one of the basic common things.
Yeah.
What would you say to that, Janet? A big focus for you?
Totally. Yeah. So I think I briefly mentioned to you when we had the chat before is, you know, mobile for me, when I first launched it with Infosys Media, one of the first things I did is I made my offshore team vet through a lot of apps just to tell me whether it's brand safe, potentially not brand safe, because obviously there was limitation around the brand safety controls within the in-app environment. So those are the kind of measures that, you know, Publicis Media has committed ourselves into, you know, doing to ensure that we're providing the level of quality for our clients. And also, I think, you know, from a PMP perspective, if I'm ever to set up a mobile PMP, you know, I basically made sure the SSP or the exchange has the ability to actually meet the basic level of brand safety first before it even gets set up. Like, I'm like, hey, you have to make sure you have to exclude all these ads. So, you know, I hold them accountable. This is how I'm holding ourselves accountable to it, too.
Yeah.
Does that feel like a familiar story for you guys at Grab?
I mean, as a brand, definitely, you know, it's very important for advertisers to learn, you know, what's happening in the market and different technology, right? At the same time, push our partners towards, you know, walking towards that technology as well. For example, I mean, we work with the MMP, and, you know, MMP have been around and they have been tracking, you know, all the Appian store, you know, all the data, right? There was a time that, you know, there was no fraud detection, you know, happening, you know, on MMP. There was not fraud detection technology, you know, time-phasing fraud detection technology happening. So a lot of brands push for that, and now, you know, that's why I have the, you know, protective-resisted adjust a similar thing. So these are the some examples of how brands can really have to push the industry towards the, you know, towards the goal of, you know, having moving that technology to a different place.
Yeah. And I'm also just wondering about whether there are any particular opportunities here in the APAC market being so mobile dominated, where we know that, you know, mobile use and adoption is accelerating really quickly in some Asian markets over others. Yeah. Is that presenting itself as a bit of an opportunity to sort of test the boundaries, particularly for you guys on the buy side, where you're going to be running campaigns across a number of environments and countries?
Yeah, I mean, I recently read a research, you know, in APAC specifically, we have about 30 apps installed, you know, on our mobile phone. And in Singapore, for example, you know, a lot of people use like 5 to 8 apps every day. So there's a lot of opportunity over there, right? So Kabir mentioned during the panel discussions that, you know, a lot of people are spending time on Facebook and, you know, Google and Facebook, you know, YouTube. But there, I think if you look at, you know, where people are spending time on outside of that, there are a lot of opportunity on how people are spending time on games, how people are spending time on lifestyle apps, how people are spending time on B2B apps as well.
Yeah.
And these are the, you know, opportunity for brands to reach out to the consumer in general.
Yeah. And of course, that's a big focus for Grab as a utility app.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an interesting story.
Lifestyle apps, yeah. So lifestyle apps, you know, games should definitely reach out to, you know, our consumer in these apps. I mean, for us as a brand, we go where our users are, right? So, and there are a lot of benefits that in-apps really brings as well, you know, superior targeting technology, right? And we talk about location, location targeting. You get a lot more, you know, data from some of the publishers, some of the partners that you work with. Like, you can start doing, you know, some cool campaigns. Or if you want to do, like, a campaign that you want to target people who frequent the malls, you know, in Singapore, you can start doing that, right? That kind of, like, targeting capability that in-app environment enables brands to do.
Yeah. Janet, any insights from across the APAC region in terms of mobile advertising from your clients in app?
I think it really, adoption-wise, really depends on the market that you're working with. Like, a lot of our SDA market, like Indonesia, I talk about Indonesia a lot because I've been involved with them a lot lately.
Yeah.
They are one of the, you know, most willing markets in terms of, like, testing mobile in-app, any kind of mobile innovation. And you would think, like, you know, they're probably a less advanced market, but the reality is, no, they're actually willing to give anything consideration in a mobile environment, and that's not just on the in-app front. So any kind of new innovation, new creative formats, they're really willing to give that a go. Whereas, funny enough, in Singapore, although Singapore is an advanced market, a lot of times Singapore is actually bit more reserved and more hesitant to test new things because they want to see other people do it
first.
Yeah.
Watch and learn.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good tactic. Mike, any sort of insight into how APAC differs from the US in terms of mobile adoption?
Well, like, you know, APAC is really like a mobile first market, depending on the country. So, like it's for many countries, people's primary internet access. So I think it is a big opportunity here for brands. You know, we were talking in that earlier session about how rewarded video is a good
just
value.
Just about to ask about that, yeah.
And that is because, like, a lot of the brands have been hesitant to embrace it over these kind of stereotypes of, is my audience in the gaming environment. But, you know, when anything gets widely adopted, right, the market price kind of goes up. And the reason is, like, there's that opportunity now. That because not, you know, a lot of brands haven't embraced certain in-app advertising or certain portions of it, they can get higher
Yeah. So that was what was going to be my sort of final question, because we did talk a little bit about reward video earlier on, and also I just want to connect that back to the last time I was here in Singapore. We had a little networking session focusing on, you know, what we're all going to be obsessing over in the advertising and marketing tech industry in 2019. And one of the things that we came up with was the potential for growth and opportunity in new channels. And, of course, connected TV and OTT was really hotly talked about last year, out of home, audio. But that sort of rewarded video piece seems to be like it is a really big opportunity that perhaps we're going to see extended and expanded a bit. Would you guys agree with that? What's your experience on the buy side?
I can start. So I think rewarded video, has kind of like a same bad rep.
Right.
So people had obviously, you know, not trusted it or just don't think, you know, you're getting really the value of it. But I think that has changed because there's so many development in terms of how you can make the creative more, you know, better call to action and all those kind of things. And, you know, if people are actually clicking after watching a video, then that means probably a lot more, right? So I think it's really, the opportunity there is still to be identified, because to be very honest with you, like from an agency perspective, we haven't really looked at how rewarded video is giving us, you know, the return, you know, how much is it, you know, benefiting us. But I think there's an opportunity there, and I think it is our job to really start digging into it and start really understanding what is the benefit of doing it. I wouldn't discredit it at all, but I would give it a bit more time before I say, hey, that's the biggest opportunity and biggest, like, upcoming format and channel.
Yeah. Stephen?
Rewarded video has a same stigma, right, around it at the moment. I mean, I would argue from the point of view, right, same thing with TV, same thing with pre-roll, right? So I think the same concept applies. The rewarded video, the reason rewarded video is that is, like, you are trying to watch an ad in exchange for a value, right? Same thing with TV as well. You're trying to watch an advertisement, you know, just to get to the content.
Yeah.
And same thing with pre-roll. You're watching an advertisement trying to get to a consumer content that you really want.
Yeah.
And I think from that point of view, right, the medium itself, the raw video, it's not a big problem. I think as a brand, you know, a lot of advertiser as brand, what do we put out in the medium? I think that's super important, right? So it's on the brand itself that, you know, we put out the message that are engaging, that are entertaining, right? That are
sophisticated.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's on the brands to put it out, right? As a medium. It's they carry an unnecessary stigma.
Mike?
Well, I think one of the important things for mobile formats like rewarded video or interstitial is to produce creatives that are really optimized for that format. Because often what we see for video is, like, the easiest thing for a brand to do is, like, recycle a TV advertisement.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've seen some really good research that says, well, even if you're going to do that, it's probably not optimal. If you're going to do that, make sure there's an in card in the video. But a lot of the creatives come in and don't have that, even though the performance is a lot better. It's not necessarily hard to do, but that just recycling your creatives from other formats isn't the way to get the best one.
Yes.
I mean, we've seen a lot of innovation around the creative in environment, you know, through reward video as well. You see, I recently seen, like, you know, in games, like, you can play the demo itself, you know, in the game, and, you know, before you actually tried it. I mean, a lot of creative innovation can happen in that environment, like that.
And should happen, really.
Yeah, should happen.
Yeah, and we see a lot of it from, like, the performance advertisers, right, who have taken good advantage of interstitials and rewarded video. And so that, like, the opportunity is for the brands to learn from that and use some of those same techniques that have worked well.
And change their perspective on performance advertising versus brand advertising. Yeah, great. Awesome. Well, we've run out of time, but thank you so much, guys. Thanks, Stefan, Jana, and Mike. And thank you, everyone in the room, for listening. And thank you for everyone listening on the podcast. That was the Mad Tech Podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, guys. Please join us for a drink and something to eat at the back of the room.